Thank you for tuning in to the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Youth Development podcast series. My name is Carrie Robidoux, and I'm a Youth Development Extension Educator, and this is the start of our fourth season with our podcast. In this podcast, we have staff from the University of Minnesota share their expertise in youth development topics, from working with volunteers and diverse audiences to research and program implications, including a variety of topics. Check out all of the seasons before this, and I'm so happy to have you on the ride with us as we start our fourth season. We will start this podcast season out with a colleague of mine named Susan Bolio. She's a tribal community facilitator on the American Indian Resource and Resiliency Team. Thank you for joining me, Susan.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks so much for having me.
Susan is going to share concepts with us today about the ACE Interface Curriculum. And that curriculum helps us understand the impact of trauma on the developing brain and resiliency factors and strategies that we as youth development professionals can implement. Now, Susan, I know that this is a topic that you have worked with extensively, and I'm wondering if you'll please talk about your work with this and how you became involved.
Yeah, so it's interesting, Carrie. So I actually got involved in this back when I was a 4-H extension educator. We had a tribal youth mentoring program in Fond du Lac, and I was trying to find different trainings and resources that we could offer our mentors. And somehow I came across ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACEs. And then there was a day-long training in the Twin Cities, and so I signed up for that, and they did like 3-ish hours on ACEs, and then they did a couple hours on historical trauma. And so that really, I remember they said they were going to be training another cohort of individuals, and I literally almost ran to the back of the room like, we need to get this into tribal communities. I was so excited to bring it back to our tribal mentors, but I didn't actually get trained then until the fall of that year, and then really got started with the work the following spring when I was asked by Minnesota Communities Caring for Children, who is the, they're the licensor for the ACE Interface Curriculum in Minnesota. They do all the trainings across the state, and they asked me to develop a project to bring this information to tribal communities. That project was called the Tribal Near Sciences and Community Wisdom Project. So we worked with over 5 tribes across the state bringing this ACE Interface Curriculum into tribal communities, training individuals in the communities to be able to be presenters, and then having the conversation around, so now what? What does this mean for us in our work? How do we apply it?
And you're now on our American Indian Resource and Resiliency Team. How do those intersect?
Yeah, so one of the things is when you understand how trauma impacts the developing brain, one of the things that we know from that is that trauma can lead to utilizing coping strategies to be able to deal with the trauma. And so sometimes those coping strategies might be using substances, it might be, you know, habits and things that aren't healthy for or helpful for us, but they help us to be able to cope. So an example would be smoking. Nicotine actually calms the nervous system. Anybody who knows smokers, or if they are a smoker, when they get really stressed out, people are like, oh, I got to have a cigarette, and they go have a cigarette, they come back, their nervous system is more balanced. And so that's kind of how this ACE study came to be too, was trying to figure out, like, they couldn't explain why they saw certain things like smoking not decreasing when they were giving information that smoking is really bad for you. And so what they're finding is that these coping strategies often can be tied back to trauma. When this position came open through the SAMHSA grant, this work around opioid use in tribal communities, it very much was connected, understanding that in our tribal communities, a lot of this unresolved trauma and grief from historical trauma and existing ACE cycles now has meant that we sort of had this compounded effect of trauma and people trying to deal with it in ways that can lead to things like substance use issues. And so when I applied for the position, I was like, this is an important piece of understanding opioid use, and we need to continue to get this information to tribal communities.
Let's segue right into the ACE study itself.
Yeah, so the ACE study, the original study, was conducted in the early 1990s by two guys, Dr. Vincent Folletti, who worked for Kaiser Permanente, and Dr. Robert Anda, who worked at the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. It was conducted with over 17 1,000 study participants, all had good health insurance through Kaiser Permanente, and they sort of asked 10 different ACEs, is what we call them. These are not the only traumas that can happen to a young person, but the 10 that they looked at sort of fall under these three categories. So there's under household dysfunction, there's things like substance use issues, parental separation or divorce, but that piece really speaks to all the chaos, fighting, craziness that happens in a household when parents aren't getting along, mental illness of a primary caregiver, domestic violence in the household, and criminal behavior. So those are the things under household dysfunction. Then under neglect, you have emotional and physical neglect. And then under abuse, there's emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. So if you total those up, there are 10 ACEs. Those are the original 10 ACEs. Since then, some communities have begun to add other things. We know that traumas don't just happen in households. They can happen in communities. So looking at things like community violence and bullying, some of those pieces have been added to some of the other ACE studies that have been done in communities since then. So that's the original ACE study and sort of what they looked at. Some of the key findings that they had is that the more trauma, the more ACEs a young person experiences, the more likely they are to experience physical, mental, emotional, social problems throughout the lifespan. So it's really important to recognize that the ACE study is not looking at a one-to-one. If you have four more ACEs, you will have X, Y, and Z, right? But it's an epidemiological study, so it's greater chance of experiencing these things. So as they looked at what were some of the implications of that, they have some things that they call ACE attributable problems. So everything from heart disease, obesity, diabetes, they have this really interesting slide that they've created. So looking at things like IV drug use. So 78% of IV drug use can be attributed to ACEs. 67% of suicide attempts can be attributed to ACEs. 69% of serious persistent mental illness can be attributed to ACEs. So when we look at these things that can be attributed to ACEs, a lot of these issues that plague our families and our society, if we can provide supports for people who currently have high ACEs and reduce ACEs in the next generation, we can have an incredible impact on a lot of these issues that are affecting our children and our families.
And again, I'll just reiterate, ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. So you're counting up how many of those a young person might have, which indicates why they're experiencing trauma.
Right. It could indicate that. And so, and another important thing that we talk about is that, so ACEs are really important. But when we talk about the resilience piece too, there are resilience buffers that when those are in place, ACEs are not people's destiny. People who have zero ACEs, but low support and hope or low support and help, or they, you know, people they can't call on when they need help, those people are actually worse off than people with 4 to 7 ACEs, but who have help and support, help and hope. So those resilience pieces, whether it's relational or whether it's individual capabilities, can act as incredible buffers against ACEs.
Okay, so going beyond ACEs then, your work has focused on the NEAR Sciences Project. Mm-hmm. What is that and why is that important? And when I say NEAR, it's NEAR.
Right? Yeah. So it's really interesting because when I started doing these presentations 4 and a half years ago, if I'd asked how many of you have heard of ACEs, maybe a couple hands would go up in the room. Now, when you ask that question, at least half, if not more, of the room has heard of ACEs, which is wonderful. But the NEAR Sciences really looks at the larger scope. So it's, we're not just looking at ACEs, but we're looking at the neurobiology and neuroscience of how does trauma impact the developing brain. We're looking at the epigenetics piece, which we'll get into in a second, the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, and then the resilience piece. Because I've also had former coworkers who said that they attended an ACEs presentation that did not include anything on resilience, and people literally left like depressed, right? So it's like, what? So now you tell us all this, what do we do with this? So the organization that trained me and I feel very strongly, when we talk about this work, it's important to touch on all of those pieces to give people a larger context for this, and then also for understanding what are some things that can be done at the individual, relational, and larger collective level to address ACEs. So when we think about neuroscience, I think neuroscience is really fascinating, but when we think about how the brain develops, first of all, it develops sequentially. So it develops from the bottom of the brain up to the top. So the spinal cord, the brain stem, all the way up to then the prefrontal cortex. So the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain that sits right behind your forehead. forehead. It's the logical, rational thinking part of the brain. That part isn't fully developed until, like, for women, it's like the mid-20s, and for men, it's actually closer to 30. So that just gives you an indication, like, the spinal cord and sort of the main structure of the brain is developing in utero, but the full brain isn't fully developed until we're almost 30, which is really incredible to think about. So it develops sequentially, and part of why that's important is because depending on when the trauma occurs, that's the part of the brain that is being, whatever part is developing at that time, that's the part that's most impacted by the trauma. So if it's a lot of trauma that happened in early childhood, you're going to see a lot of issues in the, you know, the brainstem and the limbic region, so around regulation, having a hard time connecting, building relationships, all of those things, versus if it's a little bit later, then it might be more issues with prefrontal cortex and that executive functioning piece. So that's why understanding that the brain develops sequentially and having some, you know, sometimes we can see based on the behaviors that we see when that trauma might have occurred for a young person because of the part of the brain that's been impacted. And we know that 0 to 5 is a really critical development period for brain development, but so is right before puberty. There's another time where the brain is starting to prune away things that we haven't used very often. And so that's another important brain development time where if we can have some interventions during some of these points where we know critical brain development structure and all of that is happening, we can have a greater impact. So we wire through experience. Sort of an interesting thing that I do when I do the presentation is we talk about there are some neural connections that are really thick and robust. Those are those experiences that happen over and over and over again. So they become automatic responses. We literally don't even have to think about it when, you know, when it happens. So the example I give is I tell people, and I would encourage you if you're listening to this to just go ahead and cross your arms and notice what arm is on top, your right or left arm. So then sort of shake out your arms and then cross them so the other arm is on top.
I can't do it.
Yes, I'm sort of watching you, Carrie. I love doing this in presentations because often people have to think about it to do it the other way, or they can't do it at all, or they do it and it feels really uncomfortable. So I ask people, like when I said to you the first time, cross your arms, did you have to think about it?
No, I did not.
Not the first time. But the second time you did, because the first, you know, we've crossed our arms probably a million times, you know, as we get older, probably even more, but you know, all the time, automatic response, don't have to think about it. And so those are those thick, robust connections. So part of why that's important is because we might have patterns and behaviors that are wired in through repeated experiences that at some point in our life might no longer serve us. This is another important thing when we think about the brain architecture is that sometimes people think people experience trauma, the brain is maladaptive, but the brain is always adaptive. It's always adapting to help us to survive whatever situation and environment we're in. So the trick is sometimes the patterns and behaviors later in life become maladaptive or in different contexts. So it might be adaptive at home, but in school, it might not be very helpful or adaptive. So again, thinking about the context in which these kids are in and recognizing that young people, their ability to self-regulate, their ability to share, to pay attention, all of those are not necessarily innate skills. And if their environment has been such where they grow up in a dangerous environment where they don't know what's going on, who's going to be at the home, what kind of mood they're going to be in, if they're going to be in any physical harm, if they even have a home to go, right? If there's all these unknowns and sort of dangers all the time, their brain gets wired to always be on the lookout for danger, and they have a hard time sitting still, paying attention, building relationships with people. So that's why I feel like this neuroscience piece is so critical to understanding, because we can start to see some of these behaviors in young people and understand why they're there. And one of the things that we often encourage people to think about differently when we do these presentations is to shift our thinking from a what's wrong with you or what's wrong with them to what happened to them. What happened that whatever this behavior I'm seeing, whether it's conscious or unconscious for them, makes sense based on the experiences that they've had. And if we want to see something different, how do we repeat different, you know, opportunities for kids to practice different patterns and habits to rewire a new pattern and habit? And that can take time. One of the things that I'll talk about really briefly is sort of the stress response when we think about the brain development and brain regions. The limbic region is a part of the brain that is really responsible for that fight, flight, freeze, faint response. When we experience something that's stressful, our limbic region sort of lights up, our prefrontal cortex goes offline, so that information never reaches the logical, rational thinking part of the brain, and it sort of stays stuck in that limbic region, the survival area. And so when we have a stress response, our brain and our body gets flooded with cortisol and adrenaline. So for young people whose brains are developing, the limbic region, the cerebellar vermis, both of those regions have what's called seedling cells. And seedling cells are these cells that are set to develop during certain times. So like the limbic region would be probably early adolescence. But when the brain is constantly awash with cortisol, it can be damaging or deadly to seedling cells, which is why they call that sort of constant stress, toxic stress, because it actually can be damaging to the brain cells. And you might not see the impact of that for 9 to 13 years later. So you might have a young person that grows up with lots of trauma and they seem like they're doing pretty good. And then all of a sudden they hit pre-puberty and they go off the rails. It might be because those brain regions weren't able to develop the way that they were supposed to. And so they don't have the ability to self-regulate, to build healthy relationships. Not that they don't have the ability, they do, but just they haven't built that in yet. Why understanding sort of these different brain regions and how stress impacts the brain. Another thing is, like I said, when we have a stress response, prefrontal cortex goes offline. Well, when young people are in school, they're supposed to learn, but the learning happens in the executive functioning area. So if kids are in that fight or flight response, whether they're in school or after school programs, if they're triggered by something, they literally cannot learn. It's impossible for them to learn in those moments.
I think so. You know, I really appreciate the conversation because there are times that young people walk into our classroom, they walk into our after school program, we interact with them in one way or another, and we don't understand why they aren't acting like other children are acting. They're not responding to our requests to make good behavioral decisions.
Yep. Yeah. And I think it also provides us an opportunity for understanding that in certain environments, maybe in the home environment, their brain has adapted to survive that, but then how do we help build and teach those skills that can help them be successful in these other environments that they're in, school, after school programs, you know, that teaching, and that's where, you know, there's been a lot of talk around social emotional skill building is so critical because it helps to develop those individual capabilities for young people who maybe didn't have the opportunity to learn that at home.
Well, let's segue into what this means for adults who do work with youth. And you had mentioned earlier in our conversation, resiliency. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk more about that and what this means for us as youth workers. What can we do?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about resiliency, we sort of look at the three core protective systems or factors. So we look at the individual capabilities, we look at attachment and belonging, which is the relationship piece, and then we look at the larger community culture and spirituality. So in the individual capabilities, there are sort of three main prongs to that. One of them is self-regulation. So we've talked a little bit about that. So self-regulation, Dr. Dan Siegel, he has a lot of fantastic resources. But I would encourage, if you haven't ever seen The Handy Model of the Brain, to Google Dr. Dan Siegel, Handy Model of the Brain, because when we have a stress response, like I said, the prefrontal cortex goes offline. So building in that self-regulation is both about understanding when we're about to flip our lid, noticing the sensations in our body, like what does that feel like? Where do we get these different sensations so that we can hopefully catch it before we have a full-blown stress response? And if we feel ourselves starting to have a stress response, what are those tools and strategies that work best for us that we can use to keep our prefrontal cortex online? We say hug our amygdala to keep our prefrontal cortex online. And this is the thing is, what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another's. The second piece of individual capabilities would be building up or having a positive view. So positive view is the glass is half full, good things happen to me. It's really closely tied to hope. If we believe good things happen, we tend to have hope. On the other side, if we don't believe good things happen to us and we don't have positive view, we often don't have hope. And if we don't have hope, we're not likely to ask for help because what's the point, right? So building positive view is really critical. And a simple yet effective technique for this is gratitude. having gratitude journals, doing gratitude jars, things like that. Because it's interesting, Carrie, our brains literally are wired to remember the negative. So we almost have to work extra hard to remember and see the positive. So building in some sort of a gratitude practice is a wonderful and really effective way to build positive view. And then the last piece is self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is a belief that what I do matters, that I make decisions and they impact my life. Sometimes people sort of feel like, well, you know, it doesn't matter what I do, nothing ever works out. And, you know, they sort of have this negative view of like, and self-efficacy is the opposite, that what we do does impact our life. And even though we might not be able to determine all of the things that happen to us in life, with mindfulness and awareness, we always have the ability to influence how we show up when those things happen. If we fall into those automatic patterns and habits, we're going to react versus respond. So when I think about self-efficacy, one of the important pieces is building mindfulness practices in so that we can become more aware when those automatic patterns and habits show up, so that then we can sort of pause and then we can choose how we want to respond. So that's individual capability. The last piece we'll talk about, I think, is the attachment and belonging, that relationship piece. When we talk about this, we talk about the importance of caring adults. Another important piece that we talk about is the competency. So when I think about the competency piece, I think about, I had my first child when I was 19, my first daughter. I didn't know a whole lot about how the brain develops and all of those things. I didn't know it was normal and natural for two-year-olds to tantrum and throw a fit and stuff. Now I know they're having big emotions. They don't have the language to express what they're feeling. Prefrontal cortex, far from developed, right? So I understand that now, and I respond a lot differently to my current two-year-old than I did when my oldest daughter was 2 years old, because I didn't understand that. So part of the competency when we think about those of us that work with young people is understanding sort of those typical brain development and how and when that happens, what's sort of neurotypical for some of these things. And then also thinking about the competency piece about us. So often when people are working with working with kids or with clients or whatever, they say, well, what can I do to help them? And this, somebody said this recently and it really struck me. They said the most powerful intervention is you having a regulated central nervous system. So the intervention is us as adults showing up with young people with our own regulated central nervous systems, because that helps then young people to be able to regulate easier versus like us joining them in a dysregulated chaos.
Susan, you have given us so much to think about, and I just want you to know I really appreciate how you explain brain development in a way that we can apply it with our work with young people and then better understand those youth who come into our programs and help us take a step back and begin to search out, ask questions, and have a better understanding of why those behaviors may be coming. And then great implications and strategies for us to think about how we can help that young person in our programs.
Yeah.
I would like to invite listeners to connect with Susan more. She presents on this topic. She has a wealth of information. And I know you also have resources that we may have available to us. We'll connect them to this podcast. Can you talk about the website and then the resource that we will connect to this podcast?
Yeah. So again, the organization that trained me in this curriculum is Minnesota Communities Caring for Children. And on their website, they have just a wealth of information about ACEs, neuroscience, historical trauma, resilience, what you can do. If you're interested in digging in more to understand some of these pieces, because we literally just skimmed the surface today, their website is a great place to go. Also, we'll put a link to the 2-page resilience handout that we developed through the Tribal Neurosciences and Community Wisdom Project that looks at things that you can do to build the individual capabilities, attachment and belonging, and community culture and spirituality.
Well, honestly, Susan, I could listen to you for hours talking about this topic. I learned so much from you through your experiences and through the information that you've gained through working with this curriculum and the project. Thank you again.
Absolutely.
For sharing
you again.
This with us today.
Thank you for having me. I love talking about this. It's literally changed my life. And I feel like everybody should hear it at least once. Thank you, Carrie, for having me.
As we conclude this podcast, I would like to direct our listeners to www.extension.umn.edu/youth. That's our website, and you can gain more information about training, education, and tools for youth workers. And please check out our Youth Development Insight blog and engage in the conversations that we're having there as well. Thank you again for joining me today, Susan.
Thanks, Carrie.
This is Carrie Rabideau from the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Youth Development. Please tune in again soon.